So in some sense, this talk is really just a lemma for the next talk, but it's part of joint work, but hopefully there are also a few interesting aspects of this talk. It's part of a larger program that David and I are working on in order to come up with a new method to prove R equals T theorems in situations in which they don't normally apply. But today we're going to be concentrating on a special case that in some sense is already known, but nevertheless our theorem is actually going to be a stronger result and prove something. Okay. So those who've seen my talks before know that I'm usually fairly scattered, so hopefully the confinement of using Beamer will be, let me be more precise. So I'll start with some definitions. So P is an odd prime. I actually think for most of this talk, one could get away with P equals 2, but nonetheless. N is going to be a tame level. It's an integer bigger or equal to 5 that's co-prime to P. O is a complete discrete local ZP algebra, well, that includes the nth roots of unity. Pi is going to be a uniformizer of O, and the residue field will be of a finite field K. R will just be an O algebra, which will usually be taken to either be O or the field of fractions or O mod pi to the N. X will be X1N is the modular curve of level N. So this is the smooth and proper over O. So it's the compactified modular curve. E is the universal elliptic curve, which exists because N is bigger or equal to 5. And finally, omega is the usual sheaf given by the push forward of the sheaf of relative differentials. Okay. All right, so the topic I'm going to be talking about modular forms. So what are modular forms? So the modular forms of weight n, level, tame level n, level n, and over r is given by the global sections of the sheaf omega r to the k. So k is equal to n. Yes, thanks. All right. So the Q expansion principle implies that there's an injection from this space into Q expansion. So in other words, you can detect the modular form via its Q expansion. In some sense, this is not really going to be used for most of the arguments, but it's nice just to use it as a crutch in order to understand what's going on. There are Hecker operators, and define the Hecker algebra to be the ring of endomorphisms generated by these Hecker operators on this space. So here, this N has become K. Yes. Yes. Let me be ambiguous at that point, and where that's a relevant factor, I'll say so. Okay. So I would imagine, so at this point, let's just exclude N and P. Okay. All right. So, of course, you can think about a normalized Hecker eigenform as just giving rise to a modular form, and it gives rise also to a map of the Hecker algebra, which you just send each Hecker operator to the appropriate coefficients. All right. So again, just recalling facts we all know. So associated to a Hecker eigenform, let's maybe say cuspidal as well, there exists a Galois representation. This Galois representation has the property that the trace of Frobenius is equal to the image of this Hecker operator Tx. In other words, it's just Tx for the particular eigenform, and this is for all x prime to p and prime to the level. Okay. So one can also say something very precise at primes dividing n, but let's just ignore that for now, and instead ask about what happens at p. So at p, the representation is crystalline. So what does that mean? Well, in some sense, we don't really need to know so much for this talk. The n's equal, equal to 2, there's a definition, and it's somewhat involved. But actually, if the n is equal to 1, it is has a much easier description, namely for n is equal to 1, being crystalline is the same as being unramified at P. Okay, so this is why Deline and Serre, their name is there, they constructed the representations associated to weight 1 forms. In fact, in that case, the representations have finite image, and they can be treating some isomorphism, you get a continuous map to GL2C. But in fact, the proof of Deline Serre, the proof that the representation is unramified is somewhat, it uses a trick in the fact that GL2C embeds into GL2QP for many primes P. Okay. So we can also talk about the space of modular forms mod pi. Now, it's well known that if n is bigger or equal to 2, then an easy calculation using the fact that the sheaf omega to the n has sufficiently high degree, so in particular if H1 vanishes, you can deduce that the reduction map from module forms in characteristic 0 to characteristic p is surjective. Okay. So this argument does not apply when n is equal to 1. But what that means, for example, when n is equal to 2, is that there's a surjective map on Hecker algebras. And so in particular, if you have a maximal ideal of the Hecker algebra of T acting over the finite field, then you get a Hecker algebra of T acting on O. And so in particular, you have a Galois representation. Irreducible is not necessarily true. You have a semi-simple Galois representation, rho bar M from GQ to GL2TK mod M, which is just a finite extension of K. Okay. On the other hand, in weight 1, this map is not always surjective. So probably Serre was maybe the first to predict this would be so, just because you might expect on the right-hand side to get a Galois representation to GL2K. And if this representation has image that's so large that it can't come from a representation of GL2C, then it can't come from a modular form of weight 1. And so I guess Mestre did some computations and found when n was 1429 that in fact this map did fail to be surjective if p is equal to 2. In particular, it explicitly constructed a representation with image, I think it was SL2F8, and he also constructed the module form mod 2 and that they seemed to match, and by checking this, this implied that it didn't lift. So, of course, this can be done for other values of n and other primes. Just to give one example, George Schaefer, a graduate student of Akshay, did some computations and found various other n and various other primes. And here is the n, and there's the p. So, okay, that's a prime. Okay. On the other hand, it's not so difficult, even given a maximal ideal of the Hecker algebra of a T. of the finite field to still construct a Galois representation. And we'll see how to do that in a moment, but before then, what do we know about this Galois representation? So what we know is that if you have a maximal ideal of T in weight 1, just as in high weight there exists a semi-simple Galois representation, and just as in high weight it has the property that the trace of Frobenius is just equal to the Hecker eigenvalue, but the extra property that you would want and that you can prove, which is the content of this theorem, is that this representation is unramified at P. So the reason why this is not non-trivial is that the way it's constructed is just using congruences. So it's constructed via congruences to modular forms of higher weight, and of course there's no reason that they need to be unramified at P. So Gross proved this he proves some cases in his companion forms paper, and Coleman Pollock and Eggersoven proved the other cases. Okay. All right, so let's think about modular Galois representations of weight 1. So if you think about the modular forms, what we've just said is that if you look at the modular forms of a K, there might be more Galois representations than you get in characteristic 0. On the other hand, there might be more Galois representations than you just see from the modular forms mod p. Namely, let me write it this way. I mean, of course, we just talked about Gal representations log P, so we've talked about maps from TK to some finite extension, or to the algebraic closure of K, and so this gives rise to some M and some Gal representation. But you could ask, for example, well, there could be maps, for example, to K epsilon modulo epsilon squared, and for any quotient of a Hecker algebra to some local ring, you expect to have some Gal representation valued in that ring, as long as maybe rho bar is absolutely irreducible. So you could ask, well, what about these Gal representations? Or in particular, maybe there's a module form mod P squared. I mean, if this module form characteristic zero, there'd be one of mod P squared, but maybe there's one mod P that lifts to be something mod P squared, but then doesn't lift any further. Then what can you say about those Gal representations? So it's a little bit, so that somehow lots of places where, I mean, of course, all but finitely many of these are subjective, but certainly any of them might a priori fail to be subjective. So the question is, what is the Hecker algebra that one should look at to try to capture all these representations? In particular, for example, suppose you take an eigenform mod P squared, does it have an associate Gal representation, and can you say something about its local behavior at P? So as I said, the first issue is writing down what is the right Hecker algebra. I mean, somehow writing down TK is not the right thing because it only sees characteristic P, and writing down TO is also not the right thing because it fails to see everything in characteristic P. So the right way to look at it is instead of looking at the inverse limit, just look at the direct limit. If you think about modular forms mod P to the N, so this is just coming from the modular curve itself mod P to the N, but, of course, this is just a closed subscheme of the modular curve, so you can identify the space of modular forms mod P to the N with, in fact, the cohomology of omega mod P to the N. So omega just tensor O mod pi to the N. But then, of course, O mod pi to the N maps to O mod pi to the N plus 1. I mean, not subjectively, but there's certainly a map, and so therefore you get a sequence of maps in this way, and these are all inclusions. So in particular, you consider the direct limit. And, well, you can define this just to be M1N of K mod O, which is just the direct limit of these maps. And then we define the weight 1 Hecker algebra T to be the endomorphisms of this ring. Okay. So this is somehow the right T, because it sees everything in characteristic zero, but then also sees everything in mod P. Yes, sorry, it's the image of the Hecker operators. Okay. So of course this is acting on this. It acts equally well in its Pontryagin dual. And in order to sort of understand this perhaps more directly, it turns out, and this is more an a posteriori than an a priori thing, but you can view this, this is somehow, we're sort of imagining looking at the cohomology of H0x of omega O mod pi to the N, so sort of considering this direct limit, but each of these, just by Verdier duality, you can relate to H1 of x of O mod pi to the M. On the other hand, this direct limit then becomes an inverse limit, and there's also a dual in there, so when you take Pontryagin duals, you get actually such an isomorphism. You have to be a little bit careful about the action of Hecker being twisted by Verdier duality, or this is basically Serre duality, but this is still correct. But so this is another way of viewing this Hecker algebra, namely it's acting on this H1x, so this is now something, I mean H0x omega is torsion P free, but this is now a module that certainly over O is just a finite O module, but it might have torsion. Yes. Localize it. Okay. I mean, of course, Verdier duality, you don't need to localize, but of course, the sheaf is not quite self-dual. Okay. All right. So in other words, another way of thinking, just in your mind about what T is, it's just the Hecker endomorphism acting on some finite module. Okay. So it's finite, but not necessarily torsion-free. Okay. So just by definition, there are subjections of this map onto these Hecker algebras mod p to the n, and also to the one in over O. So it somehow sees module forms mod p and module forms and the weight ones, classical module forms. Okay, so as I just said. So now the main theorem is just essentially to describe the local behavior of the representations coming from this Hecker algebra T. So I call it local global compatibility. So let me just write down the statement first. So you take a non-Eisenstein maximal ideal, then, as you expect, there is a Gauss representation to GL2T, and again, the trace of Frobenius is Tx, x prime to NP, and the content is to show that this representation is unramified at P. So this is somehow, so if you combine this representation to the map to GL2T Tm mod m, you just recover the result of Gross, Coleman, Volokh, etc. Okay. So local compatibility is just saying the representation is what you expect to be at P. You could also ask what happens at N, but you get exactly the same thing as in higher weight. There's not really any difficulty, or it's just the same. Okay. It's also true that the trace of Frobenius is equal to TP, and that TP is somehow included in this Hecker algebra, whether you define it to be or not. Okay. So actually, the existence of the Gauss representation is somehow easy to do, and somehow just it's well known how to construct it. I mean, to construct it on T, you just need to construct it on T mod some exhausting sequence of ideals. So you construct it on Ti mod M, where Ti mod M, T mod Im, is acting faithfully on the module forms mod P to the N, or pi to the M. And how do you construct the Gauss representation there? We use congruences. Namely, you multiply by a suitable power of that Hasse invariant. A suitable power is going to lift to something mod pi to the M. And by multiplication, you simply get a map, which is a T equivariant, from your space to now some space in higher weight, and now that lifts to characteristic zero, and you have the Gauss representation coming from higher weight, and so you get the Gauss representation on M1. So this, of course, works quite generally. Originally, Deligne Sell is how they construct the row coming from congruences. But of course, this loses information at P, certainly. So that's what you have to recover. So what I want to talk about first is just the special case, which corresponds to the case essentially treated by Gross, which is really the easy case. First, of course, by the theorem of Coleman, Volokh, and Gross, et cetera, you can assume its row bar is unramified at P. But so what's the easy case? The easy case is that Frobenius actually have distinct eigenvalues. So this is distinct mod P, of course. Okay, so why is this the easy case? So of course, we're trying to show this representation is unramified at P. So in particular, we're trying to show it's ordinary. So what we can try to do is prove that it's ordinary. And moreover, it's proved that it's ordinary and has unramified quotient, as ordinary representations too, on which Frobenius acts by some lift of alpha. Okay. So we can prove this. And then we can also prove that rho is ordinary at P, which it has an unramified quotient on which Frobenius acts by some lift beta. And because then alpha and beta are distinct, if you consider the module that you get, it just decomposes into a direct sum of free of rank 2, and there's two free of rank 1 things in which Frobenius is acting by alpha and by beta, and that splits the representation locally, and you see that it's unramified. Okay. That's the goal. Okay, so how do we do this? Well, again, we just need to be a little bit more careful with how we construct the Gauss representation by congruences. So previously, we were just multiplying by some power of the Hasse invariant, and we somehow got one copy of our space of modular forms in higher weight. So if you imagine that the ordinary spaces with alpha and beta are somehow separate, then what we really want to do is come up with two copies of the space of modular forms of weight one. Okay. Which morally, you can think of as the two old spaces at level gamma 0 p corresponding to so two copies. So we need a map which sends two copies of that space of weight 1 forms into weight n. So we want to define as follows. So one of the maps is clear, so the map we already have. You can multiply it by the Hasse invariant, or some power of the Hasse invariant. If you want to think about two expansions, it's just the identity. Another map is as follows. Well, what you can do is you can first apply the Hecker operator. Well, there's two things. You have Hecker operator p. One, you can apply it first and then take the map, or you could take the map and then apply it. And these are different just because if you think explicitly in terms of Q expansions, you can kind of see explicitly that it's different. And in fact, if you want to think about, well, this is on Q expansions, it's really just the map given by Q goes to Q to the P. So, of course, mapping to higher weight, this is somehow a substitute for, of course, you don't want to think about torsion things. You don't want to think about the curve x0 of P, which has bad reduction at P, if you want to do things for P torsion. So in some sense, the substitute for moving to level gamma 0 p by moving to higher weight, but still level 1. So you have two maps. This map is equivariant with respect to the Hecker operators away from p. Oops, sorry. And then the key point is that this is really an injection. So you really see two copies. So this is something that actually seems to be true more generally, so in for other groups, but what usually happens is that it's a fairly cheap proof in weight 1 that doesn't generalize so well, but nonetheless, let me just give it to you. So it's T equivariant, so you may as well just check it. Well, I'm not even going to use that. You can check it mod P. And so what you see, you have a map which is just given by the identity and a map given by sending Q to Q to the P. So if one was in the image of the other, that would mean you had a form of weight 1 that looked like that looked like something in terms of Q to the P, so it would be killed by Q to Q. So it would be in the kernel of theta, but the theta doesn't have any kernel in weight 1, which is the theorem of Katz. Okay, so there's something a little bit confusing is that, so here we have 1 squared mapping to Mn. So here there's a Hecker operator Tp acting on this, and here's the Hecker operator TP. Because they have the same symbol, it's somewhat confusing to write them the same. So I'm going to write the Hecker operator here as UP. Well, this seems also like a bad choice of symbol because UP means something else. But these are somehow modular forms mod pi to the n. So if you want to think concretely in terms of Q expansions, of course, well, let me just write this down. So TP is equal to UP plus p to the k minus 1 vp. So an equation like this. So if you sort of imagine this is what tp, well, first you can see why tp is going to be different depending on the weight. Secondly, you can see that if you're at very high weight compared to n, then tp is certainly just acting like up. Okay, so I'm just going to call this up just because I don't want to use tp. I don't want to have any other subscripts. Okay. So you can check, just by definition of this map, that if you look at UP acting on this space, then it satisfies a quadratic equation in terms of the action of TP. Well, the TP, of course, is acting on the image here, so it satisfies this quadratic equation, which you can just imagine as doing exactly what we want this map to do. Namely, we're thinking of this right hand of this map as a way of representing the space of all forms of level P, on which, of course, we normally have UP satisfying this relation. Okay. So let's suppose we're still in the case in which alpha is not equal to beta. Then this factor is mod the maximum ideal is just UP minus alpha times UP minus beta. So we can just localize the image at both these ideals, and you can show that essentially one copy gets localized to UP minus alpha, and another copy gets localized to UP minus beta, and so you get two copies, and that gives you the Galois representations that you wanted, namely the one localized at alpha. You now have a copy of M1 for which UP is acting by some list of alpha. And so you see it's ordinary, and you get exactly what you want, and the same for beta. Right, but you see, you have to do something a little bit different when alpha is equal to beta. I mean, of course, you can do the same thing, but when you localize, of course, you now have everything. And of course, if you know that it has a quotient which it acts by alpha and a quotient which it acts by alpha, that doesn't tell you anything. So you have to do something a little bit different. So what happens when alpha is equal to beta? Okay. So we still see that when we take P mod IM, what we get is the quotient of an ordinary representation. In other words, we've just shown from this formula I wrote down before that UP is satisfying some quadratic relation. So UP squared minus TP UP plus P is equal to zero, from which you can see that P is invertible. That UP is invertible. So it's certainly in some ordinary space. Okay. So now, since we're going to have more than one Heck algebra, I'm going to say Tn is the O Heck algebra in weight n generated by Tx for x prime to p. Okay, and then I'm going to let T twiddle n be T along with this Heck operator at UP. Okay, so it's often the case that when you omit the Heck operator at p, you can somehow get it back, but it's not always the case. And in particular, if you think about ordinary representations in high weight, it's certainly not the case that you can always recover this Heck operator. I mean, if you think of what you have, if you have an ordinary representation, I mean, what can you really tell from the Heck algebra if you have the Heck, if you don't have the Heck operators at P? You can tell what the Gower representation is. So you can ask, if you know what the Gower representation is, can you tell what UP is, which is given the eigenvalue for Frobenius on this quotient? Well, if you know what the Gower representation is, you know what the trace of some lift of Frobenius is. So you can tell what the trace of this matrix is, and you can tell what the determinant is. So you can at least solve for UP up to some quadratic equation. And of course, you'll know what it is for valuation reasons in general, but what it means is these Heck algebras, this UP, will satisfy some quadratic relation. But that doesn't mean it's kind of literally equal to this. UP might satisfy some further relations. And it might actually be the case that UP does actually lie in Heck algebra. But it's at least a quotient of this. Okay. So you can ask, well, how close is TNM to TNM twiddle? So you have some maximal idea. How close is UP to already being in there? Well, I can give some answer. If alpha is not equal to beta, it is in there because you can, if you look at mod M, it splits into two distinct factors. So by Hensel's lemma, it's not. But in general, in fact, they are going to be different. So somehow the QP bar points are the same. I mean, somehow, if you know a modular form, you know what it, if you know what the Gower representation is, you know what the modular form is. But in general, they're different. And it's not so hard to come up with explicit examples. So this difference is somehow important. Okay. So what I want to talk about is a local analog of this. So just think about the local situation. And the hardest case will be the case in which rho bar is just completely trivial. So let's take a representation of GQP that's locally trivial. So that this is trivial. Okay. So then what can we do? Well, you can have a universal frame local deformation ring, so that records all deformations. Okay. And from that, you can construct a Kissen-style quotient, which corresponds to, well, it cuts out, the key point is this generic fiber is giving you the ordinary deformations with some properties that you want for modularity, say in particular, fixed determinant and Hodge state weights equal to n and zero. Okay, so here n is bigger than, no, even bigger than one here. Okay. So there is such a ring. Okay. And it's the local analog of T. Right? Somehow, it's giving you the representation. But we said we wanted something more. We wanted to know something about UP. So how do we think about UP? Well, instead of considering just the universal deformation ring, you consider extra information. You consider the universal frame local deformation ring together with some eigenvalue of some lift of Frobenius. So this will actually literally be just a quadratic extension of R. Okay. And then finally, well, now you can consider the analog of this Kissen space, namely consider a ring which records ordinary deformations But together with the local analog of the UP operator, which is some eigenvalue Frobenius, but you want not just any eigenvalue Frobenius, you want the eigenvalue Frobenius on the unramified quotient. Okay. So just as in the global case, it contains the representation. On the other hand, this eigenvalue satisfies the quadratic relation in the traces, so it satisfies some quadratic relation, but it could be smaller than that, right? Because we're not just saying with any eigenvalue Frobenius, we particularly want the one that's on the unramified quotient. So again, let's compare these rings. If you have something in characteristic zero and it has Hodge Tate weights, well, one of them is zero and one of them is not, then you can certainly recover. I mean, you know, if you have the representation locally over a field will be the sum power of the cyclohelmic character 001. So you can tell which is the unramified quotient. Yeah, so, right, maybe I, since I, right, so somehow, this is just the kind of, this is the local thing, this is the ordinary thing, this is sort of plus Frobenius, and this is plus kind of the unramified Frobenius. Okay, so if you compare these things in characteristic zero, again, the points are basically the same. So the generic fibers basically look the same. Okay. So now the question is, well, how to tell how basically the points of these are the same, of the generic fiber. Okay. So now the question is, how different is this than this? So this is given by a quadratic extension. Well, UP satisfies some quadratic extension, but there are more relations. So the question is, well, how far is this from being a quadratic extension? So looking at generic fiber, I mean, it's somehow a long way, but to try to measure how far this is from being a quadratic extension, you can consider the quotient of this by this, and it's a module for this, and the question is, well, how close is this to being free? Right? If it was really a quadratic extension, it would just be free. So the one way to measure this is to take an ideal, which would just be annihilated. Well, the quotient. Yes, if these were equal, this quotient would be zero, and you'd have the whole thing. If this was literally a quadratic extension, the ideal would be zero. Okay, so in other words, another way of thinking about it is the smallest quotient on which it really is a quadratic extension is when you quotient out by I. Okay, so this is measuring, right. So we'll call this the doubling ideal. So that's what I just said. So it's the largest quotient of which it's a quadratic extension. So we know it's somehow, this ideal is not, I mean, this ideal literally could be the entire ring if you're in situations which these say are equal. Okay. So now let me give another ideal. So an ideal I think they look different. So now this is the smallest ideal such that this quotient is unramified. Okay. So if you think, what would it mean to be unramified? Well, already this says Hodge has determinant, say, the cyclotomic character to the n. So already this quotient would have to, the cyclotomic character to the n would have to be congruent to 1. So this quotient will already be something that's kind of killed by some small power of p. Okay. So the point, well, it's good that it's not so bad that these are hard to distinguish because they're the same. So let me just somehow morally explain why this is true. So, well, one inclusion is kind of clear. If I try to say what inclusion it is, I'll get myself confused because I don't understand inclusions. But let's just imagine you had an unramified quotient, right? If you look at an unramified quotient, you have your ordinary unramified quotient, well, then you can't tell what the UP operator is because both of the eigenvalues are unramified. So when you look at the unramified quotient, you really expect this to be a quadratic extension, because there you can't tell the Frobenius apart. So that gives you an inclusion in a way that you can, I won't dare guess. Okay. So the only way you can distinguish between the two eigenvalues of Frobenius is when there's ramification. So you might really imagine that, in fact, that's the only way that you can't distinguish them. right? In other words, if there was ramification, then hopefully you could tell the things apart, and therefore you would have that. So, yeah, I mean, that's the idea, and in fact, that leads to a proof. Okay. So what's the point about this? Well, the point about this is that from it you can deduce, I mean, this, we're trying to construct, we have some ordinary thing, we're trying to construct something that's unramified. Right? If we go back to our situation, we have a weight one form, and we've constructed some ordinary representation, and we want to try to show that it's unramified. Okay. What this says is that it suffices to show, not that it's unramified, but suffices to show that it gives rise to a doubling. It gives rise to something for which, for how the heck operator X, that the UP doesn't satisfy any other relations except for this quadratic relation. But if you go back to our construction really was, we really had two copies. Yeah. We really had two copies of M1, at least by some power of P, mapping inside MN, and U satisfies this quadratic relation, but it's easy to see that it doesn't satisfy any other relations. So because you literally have these two copies, you can see that you're really in a situation in which you have kind of doubling of Hecker algebras. So that's what you can produce by this map, and then you want to show this doubling translates into being unramified, and that's a statement that you can detect by some local argument. Okay, so in other words, well, maybe what I just said might be easier to understand than this. Okay, so in other words, so the quotient which acts on this image has the property that it, you have some doubling, and so therefore, and the associated Galois representation is the one we wanted, and so therefore that you deduce that it's unramified. Okay. So, okay. So previous arguments along these lines use somehow global methods. I mean, well, first, then the alpha is not equal to beta case. Gabor Weiser has some results on a slightly different case in which Frobenius is has the same eigenvalues but is not scalar. And there you can use some kind of global arguments that are very related to proofs of multiplicity, which are geometric multiplicity one. Namely, these level lowering results proved, say, by Buzzard, et cetera, in which you kind of use these arguments. But these arguments somehow just fail to give the result in this case. You really need some other argument. Okay. Well, this leads me on to the next topic. This is somehow just, this is a very classical topic and is related to some of these original questions of studying weight one modular forms, which is the question of multiplicities. Okay. So now let's just start with an irreducible modular representation. And let's assume also it has minimal Serre conductor and weight amongst all its twists. Okay. So we can define N star. Well, in some sense, it's either the Serre conductor or it's a P times. No, it's basically the Serre conductor or P times the Serre conductor. So it's the Serre conductor if you're in weight two, and N times P otherwise. So okay, so this is just going to relate. If you want to see your module form in weight 2, well, of course, you see it in weight 2 at the Serre conductor if K is 2, but not otherwise. Okay. So because it's modular and by level lowering, essentially, but then this rho bar gives rise to a maximal ideal of the full Hecker algebra, so now I really want to include TP, acting on this Jacobian. So here's the following theorem, multiplicity one. So this is a geometric statement about the Jacobian of modular curves. So you can look at this action, and then you can look at the Tate module, or since you just want to look at M torsion, you can just look at the part of the Jacobian killed by M, and by, well, first by a result of, I guess, the Leinster, Ribbett, and Boston, well, not quite alphabetical, you know that, in fact, what you get is just some number of copies of rho bar. The fact that it's modular means there's at least one copy. So the theorem in these cases is you get exactly one copy. Okay. So, of course, if you don't want to assume Serre's conjecture, but you perhaps know this, maybe you have some extra tame level that occurs, It's somehow useful to perhaps prove these types of statements in order to prove level lowering, or at least historically that's the case. So what I talk about the rest of the time is the following theorem called multiplicity 2, which is the other case. So the previous theorem dealt with the case that Rho-Weil was in every situation except for the case in which it was unramified and Frobenius was a scalar. So in this case, the multiplicity is actually equal to exactly 2. So in fact, just by examining the proofs of multiplicity 1, it's not, I think Weiser had shown that multiplicity was always at least 2. Okay. So, probably most of you are too young, but so multiplicity 1 used to be like an ingredient in proving modularity lifting theorems, and sort of figured prominently in, say, Ribot's work and in Wiles' work, and then basically, I guess, Fred Diamond killed it off by essentially showing that one could deduce multiplicity a posteriori from the proof. Okay. And in fact, our argument is essentially in this spirit, namely in the sense of these original theorems were really difficult theorems about the geometry of modular curves, but then essentially Diamond's argument showed that instead of thinking about the geometry of modular curves, you consider just the geometry of the local deformation ring. And of course, in the cases in which it was smooth, for example, we get multiplicity 1. Okay. So again, we're going to return to these rings that I talked about previously. So the first remark, so this is showing how this is not so useful for proving modularity. The first thing that you'll need is some modularity result. Okay. So in other words, you can prove modularity of the Hecker ring at this level. So here, right, so here we have n star, and t is just the weight 2 Hecker algebra. So here, just tp is not here in t. Okay. And then r is just the local ordinary deformation ring, appropriately defined. And so, well, of course, you would hope that r is equal to t, but you only really get r1 on p is equal to t1 on p, essentially because, right, this is somehow the first situation in which you really have to start putting in some Kissin ring, because, I mean, this r twiddle before is not really, it's not representing a functor. It's really just a ring that has some properties. So you get such a thing. Okay. Now, in fact, in proving r equals t results, you can include extra information. So instead of thinking about modularity, or instead of somehow patching together Hecker algebras without TP, you can patch together Hecker operators with the TP. But then, of course, you need to adjust R as well. Instead of thinking about your just any deformations, you have to consider deformations with an eigenvalue of Frobenius on some unramified quotient, which is exactly somehow this R twiddle before. Unfortunately, before R twiddle was a local thing, this is, we're now a global thing. I can see Florin was very upset by that. Okay. So what does the argument give you? Kissin-style argument. So what you see is that this global frame deformation ring is really, is given by a quotient of some local information. So, well, here actually, here I've maybe been, there's a parenthesis missing. So you have to worry about the local deformation ring at P, local deformation rings at the primes dividing N, and then you have a power series ring. And then what you see is that your twiddle is just a quotient of this by some sequence of parameters. Okay. So, all right. So what we'd like to do is get more information about, for example, perhaps r is equal to t, or some more information about r t, or at least r twiddle or t twiddle. Okay. So the key point to use is that this ring, r twiddle dagger, is actually Cohen-Macaulay. So this is a result of Snowden, with a view, I guess, to proving integral versions of R equals T results. I mean, the point is when you have something Kawamukole, and then you take quotients by sequence of parameters and you have something of the appropriate dimension, what you actually see is you have regular sequences. So in fact, well, first you see that, so you have this deformation ring at P is Kawamukole. So the deformation rings at primes dividing N, they're either smooth or they're something pretty close to smooth. They're complete intersections. So what you see is you get something that's still Kawamukole. And so what you can deduce is that this global deformation ring R twiddle is also Kawamukole and also torsion free. So you don't quite get R equals T, but you do get from this that R prime is equal to T prime. Okay. Just because you know that they're the same when you insert P, but you know that one is torsion free. Okay. So essentially, I mean, how do you get from this to R is equal to T? You would want to show that, say, R is torsion free. And that's the problem you have to worry about. Okay, so why is this useful? Well, okay. So let me just say a few words about Kawamukole rings. So, well, at least Kawamukole rings under some any reasonable hypothesis, so certainly if you take a complete local Kawamukole ring, then it has a dualizing module, which has it's just a finite A module with various properties with regards to the X functor, but it is what it is, and it has some minimal number of generators, mu A. So for example, if mu A was equal to 1, A would be Gorenstein. Because omega A would be A itself. Okay. So this invariant, well, you can see by a fairly simple argument that it's preserved by taking the quotient by a regular sequence. Okay. So certainly if you take a Kawamukole and you take a quotient by a regular element, you get something still Kawamukole, but this invariant is also the change because the dualizing module you also just get by quotienting out by the element. But what that also means is that if you replace A by, say, a power series ring, it has the same invariant, but then if you then take A tensor a complete intersection, well, that's like taking A tensor a power series ring, quotient out by a regular sequence. Okay. So what this means is, so this R local, right, so let me just call the situation. So here we have R dagger tensor a bunch of local deformation rings at V away from P, which are hopefully just very simple, and some power series ring. And that's going to R by quotienting out by a regular sequence. Okay. So what does this mean? Well, if we take this is Kawamukole that has some invariant. So if you tensor with this ring, these are all complete intersections, so this invariant remains the same. You take a power series ring, this invariant remains the same. You take the quotient by a regular sequence, this is still Kawamukole, and this invariant is still the same. So what you have is this ring is not just Kawamukole, but it's Kawamukole, and you know that this invariant, which is the size of its dualizing module, is just a local invariant. It's coming from that itself. Okay, so you can deduce that R twiddle is Kawamukole with this same invariant. And then because this is equal to T, localized at M, this is also Kawamukole with this invariant. So you've deduced some fact about your deformation ring or your Heckert ring just via the geometry of some local deformation ring. Okay, so how do we then translate this literally into some fact about geometry that we wanted to know? So let's go back to what Gross proves. So what he proves is that if you look at the Tate module, well, you can decompose it by essentially, well, the Tate module you're thinking is really roughly in an Attal H1, so or an H1 Durham, and so therefore it has a Hodge decomposition, and so you can somehow break it up into the and it's also if you're looking at the case in which we're something ordinary, you have like an ordinary part and an Attal part. Okay, so it has some decomposition. Moreover, this is stable under TM. It's in fact, as a Galois module, of course, it could be non-split, but as a T module, it's somehow split. Moreover, The Attell pot is free of rank 1. That's basically coming from the Q expansion principle. And finally, the ordinary pot is just the dual of the Attell pot. So for example, if you're in a situation in which your T is Gorenstein, then what you know is that the dual is basically the same with Gorenstein of dimension 1, then ZP dual is the same as itself. And in particular, both sides are free of rank 1, and therefore what you get is free of rank 2, which is exactly the same as multiplicity 1. Okay. Now the statement that for Gorenstein rings, the dual that's Gorenstein if the ZP dual is the same, that's just really a statement relating to the fact that if you take the Z, if you have something that's, say, finite over a local ring, then the dual is exactly the dualizing module. Right? So the Gorenstein statement is its own dualizing module. So here, what we see is that the dualizing module is TM. So what does that mean in our situation? It means we can now relate it, because we know something about the dualizing module. Namely, if you try and look at the M torsion, well, we have a free part that gives 1, and then another part whose M dimension gives you this invariant, and that gives you the rank of the K vector space, but of course the representation rho M has dimension 2, so you have to divide by 2. Yes, that the number of row bars. So if it was just the dimension, there shouldn't be a divided by 2 there. Right, but the multiplicity, you have to divide by 2. Okay, so already, without doing anything else, this already shows that the multiplicity is a purely local invariant that just depends on P. So then you need to actually compute it. So you need to do some computation in this ring. How do you compute it? Well, this invariant is preserved under taking regular sequences. So you can just take a regular sequence, you get something that's has dimension 0, but when you have a dimension 0 Cohen-Macaulay ring, its dualizing module is just the supple. Okay, so you just compute it module an explicit regular sequence, and what you get is the following ring, which is, in fact, the simplest example of a ring that's not Gorenstein, but in particular has the property the dualizing module is AM, and this dimension is 3, which is good because that's odd. And so you see that this number is 3, and therefore the multiplicity is equal to 2. Okay. Well, I think I'll stop there.